Life Talk Radio presents Health and Longevity, the program dedicated to bringing you cutting-edge information and interviews that can change your life. On each edition, nutritionist, registered dietitian, and board-certified anti-aging health practitioner, Dr. John Westerdahl, will show you how to achieve a longer, healthier life using the latest breakthroughs in nutrition, wellness, and lifestyle medicine. And now, here's your host, Dr. John Westerdahl.
Welcome to Health and Longevity. I'm Dr. John Westerdahl. Everyone knows how hard it can be to maintain a healthy diet. But what if some of the decisions that we make about what to eat are beyond our control? Is it possible that food is addictive, like drugs or alcohol? And to what extent does the food industry know or care about these vulnerabilities? In the new book, Hooked, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter Michael Moss sets out to answer these questions and to find the true peril in our food. Our special guest today is Michael Moss, the author of the brand new book, Hooked, Food, Free Will, and How the Food Giants Exploit Our Addictions. Today's program is part one of a two-part radio interview that I did with Michael Moss. But before we get into today's exciting topic, let's listen to this important message.
Would you like to live a happier, healthier, and longer fulfilled life? Then visit us at healthandlongevityradio.com. That's one word, healthandlongevityradio.com. There you'll find valuable information and resources that can help you achieve optimal health and give you the secrets to longevity. Visit us today at healthandlongevityradio.com. Once again, that's healthandlongevityradio.com. It could change your life.
Dr. Westerdahl presents the Health and Longevity News and Research Update, bringing you the most pertinent and important information about your health and longevity.
Well, here's an interesting article that says that plant protein may play a beneficial role in longevity. This according to an article that appears in the Journal of the American Medical Association Internal Medicine. Plant protein seems to have certain health and cardioprotective benefits that may increase longevity. Researchers from the National Cancer Institute recently published the results of a study that followed approximately 400,000 men and women, 62 years old on average, at the start of the study, and over a period of 16 years. Now, at the start of the study, the subjects' median protein intake from plants was about 40%. Plant protein sources included bread, cereal, pasta, nuts, beans, legumes, and other plant proteins. And the remaining protein was found from animal sources, which included meat and dairy. Now, the researchers compared these plant proteins to animal proteins from red meat, white meat, defined as poultry and fish, and dairy products and also eggs. They found that consuming more plant protein was related to a lower risk of dying from cardiovascular diseases and of death in general. The overall risk reduction in death, regardless of the cause, was independent of smoking status, diabetes, fruit consumption, and supplement use, indicating that switching to plant proteins may reduce risk of death despite certain lifestyle choices. Additionally, the researchers showed that replacing 3% of the calories that came from animal protein overall with plant protein resulted in a 10% reduction in risk of dying for both men and women, irrespective of the type of animal protein. When the researchers examined different sources of animal protein using the same 3% substitution model, replacing eggs with plant protein was associated with a 24% lower risk of death in men and a 21% lower risk in women. Replacing red meat with plant protein also resulted in risk reduction of death in men 13% and women 15%. And substitution of dairy with plant proteins resulted in an 8% reduction across both genders. Now, interestingly, the substitution model for white meat with plant protein did not show significant benefits. In summary, plant proteins may be superior to animal protein for overall longevity and reduction of risk from dying of heart disease. even small substitutions of certain animal proteins with plant proteins could help increase lifespan.
We will be back after this short break.
Would you like to live a happier, healthier, and longer fulfilled life? Then visit us at healthandlongevityradio.com. That's one word, healthandlongevityradio.com. There you'll find valuable information and resources that can help you achieve optimal health and give you the secrets to longevity. Visit us today at healthandlongevityradio.com. Once again, that's healthandlongevityradio.com. It could change your life.
Welcome back to Health and Longevity. Do you have questions about nutrition, health, or longevity? This is your chance to have them answered. On each program, Dr. Westerdahl will choose a key question from our listening audience and respond to it on the air. Due to the high volume of emails, Dr. Westerdahl cannot personally answer each question on our broadcast. If you would like to submit a question, please go to our website, healthandlongevityradio.com. Once there, you will see a button to submit your questions. And now, the question of the day.
And our question for today is, can eating berries help in improving brain health? We know berries in general show great promise in slowing and reversing many of the degenerative diseases that are associated with an aging brain. Now, with a high ORAC value, now ORAC is O-R-A-C, this is a measure of the antioxidant capabilities of certain foods, and ORAC stands for oxygen radical absorbance capacity. And blueberries, blackberries, strawberries, and raspberries can actually offset the oxidant damage that may cause vascular damage, leading to memory and thinking impairments. So this is very important. And it's interesting that in particular, blueberries are emerging as one of the best foods that protects brain health. Now, there was a study by researchers at the U.S. National Institute of Aging that showed that blueberries were found to help lessen some of the functional damage caused by brain injury. So in the future, consumption of blueberries and other berries may represent significant positive advancement that can help with brain aging, Alzheimer's disease, and other neurological disorders. So I encourage you to include more berries in your diet, particularly blueberries, but also these other berries, because they can have a very beneficial effect on the health of your brain. Include them in your diet. Add them to your foods. I have blueberries every day as part of my breakfast, so I want to make sure I get plenty of blueberries. So I encourage you to include more blueberries and other berries in your diet because they can have a great benefit on the health of your brain.
And now, Health and Longevity's special feature, where Dr. Westerdahl interviews leading experts and personalities on vital topics important to your health and longevity.
Our special guest today on Health and Longevity is Michael Moss. Michael Moss is the author of the number one New York Times bestseller, Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. A Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, formerly with the New York Times, Michael is a keynote speaker and an occasional guest on shows like CBS This Morning, The Dr. Oz Show, CNN's The Lead, All Things Considered, and The Daily Show. And today we're going to be talking about Michael's newest book called Hooked, Food, Free Will, and How the Food Giants Exploit Our Addictions. Well, Michael, thank you so much for being with us today here on Health and Longevity.
Thank you so much for having me.
So tell us a little bit about your background and how you became an investigative reporter and how you started this journey into studying about the food industry, particularly the food industry and its using salt and sugar and fat and increasing their sales for those products so people got hooked on them. How did this all start?
Such a small question. It was a bit of an accident. So I've been trained in investigative journalism at some of the best newspapers in the country, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times. And, you know, shockingly, in 2008, I was actually in Algeria interviewing some Islamic militants when a couple of FBI agents showed up at the New York Times headquarters in New York looking for none other than me. I'd been traveling to Iraq, tormenting the Pentagon for failing to equip American soldiers with body armor. And then I was traveling around the Middle East, looking critically at the war on terrorism. And the FBI agents said that I had managed to land myself on an Al-Qaeda hit list. I think it may have been the government of Algeria just trying to get rid of me, but the Times couldn't take a chance, and they ordered me on the next flight home that night. And I was sitting around with my editors at the time, sort of looking for something new to do here in the United States, somewhat safer, when my editor suggested to me that I might want to look at this outbreak of salmonella that was occurring in peanuts being manufactured on the Georgia-Alabama border. And I went down there, and it was this incredibly tragic story of the processed food industry losing control over its food chain, because weeks and weeks were going by and the companies were still trying to figure out which of their dozens of products to recall that were using these peanuts as ingredients, because they couldn't tell immediately from their food chain documents. And then I started to look at other contaminated foods, including E. coli and hamburger. And I was having dinner one night with a good source of mine who tests meat for the food industry for E. coli. And he said to me, you know, Michael, as tragic as these incidents of contamination are, you really should look at things my industry is intentionally adding to its products, over which it has total control. He was worried about all the salt that goes into processed meat. But that led me to look at sugar and then fat, added fats and oils, as this unholy trinity, if you will, on which the processed food industry relies on to make its products really low cost, yummy, convenient, and irresistible kind of to the brain. And that was the subject matter pretty much of my first book, Salt, Sugar, Fat, because I was incredibly lucky to come across this trove of documents that took me inside the largest processed food companies as they were formulating and marketing and positioning their products. And it was those documents that enabled me to meet key insiders in the industry, opened up even more about the secrets they do. And the overwhelming sense you get from that material in those industries that's been driving day and night to get us to not just like their products, but to want more and more of them. But when Salt, Sugar, Fat came out, one of the very first questions from reporters was, because I was trying to be a little hopeful at the end of the book and saying that, look, knowledge is power, and knowing what these companies are doing can help us decide what to eat and how much. But the reporter said to me, well, wait a minute, though, isn't this stuff you're writing about addictive like drugs? And if that's the case, you know, where is the opportunity for us to have any say in the matter, any willpower? And at first, I have to tell you, I was a little kind of taken aback and skeptical. I mean, Twinkies like heroin, right? I mean, where's the harsh chemicals in Twinkies? And where's, you know, how come not everybody loses control of Twinkies? And who's going to, you know, rob a drugstore to get, you know, Twinkies like somebody might to get sort of heroin? But the more I looked and the more I sort of talked to scientists who used to study drug addiction and now study food addiction, and crawling back inside the underbelly of this trillion-dollar processed food industry has left me convinced that many of its products in many ways are even more trouble for us than cigarettes, alcohol, and drugs, because they've learned how to not just use additives like salt, sugar, fat, but how to tap into and exploit our basic biology in a way that's made overeating an everyday thing in this country.
Well, you know, it's interesting you bring up Twinkies, because I remember years ago there was the Twinkie defense. Remember that, where someone ate Twinkies and killed someone or something, and they go to prison?
Lost control of their actions and sort of made them so good. There's actually sort of something to that.
Yeah.
But I should say, too, up front, it's not just Twinkies. It's not just junk food, what we know as sort of snack food. We're talking about much of the grocery store, where products are engineered for ultimate convenience and exquisitely in a way that ends up wanting more and more of them to the point where we lose control of our eating habits.
I remember years ago, back in the 70s, there was a whole interest and even some books and other papers on it with, in the area of psychonutrition, dealing with the psychological effects. It's kind of interesting. This is just a side story, but I was doing a radio show in Honolulu. I used to live in Hawaii and had a weekly radio program there. And someone heard my show because I was talking about MSG and some other ingredients and foods. And I got a call from somebody. He wanted to invite me to lunch to meet with him because he had done a lot of studies in this area of these food additives and their effects. And evidently, this guy, this is a strange story. So here I am. We had lunch together and we started talking. And he told me that he was drinking some wine once and it had an effect on him. And he actually shot somebody and went to jail for it. Mm. And I'm thinking, boy, here I'm having lunch with someone. I'm taking my own life into my own hands, having a discussion with someone like that. It's very strange.
Well, it is a peculiar story. One of the things to know about sort of food and addiction and drug addiction is that it affects people differently.
Right.
Not everybody will lose control of Oreo cookies or Hot Pockets or Lunchables. And that's been one of the defenses of the food industry to me, which is, how can you blame our products when not everybody is obese in this country, for example, having lost control? But the same thing is true of smoking, alcohol, and even harsher narcotics like heroin. And I'm not advising anybody to do this, but there are people who can casually smoke occasionally.
Right.
You know, use alcohol moderately, even use heroin on a casual basis. And so the parallels between that and these food products is even clearer.
Well, let's talk about this whole area, because I know you talk about the beginnings of the book on addiction. And there's a number of definitions about addiction. What is your definition of addiction, or the one that you think describes it more accurately, particularly when it comes to food?
I'll give you the latter, because one of the things I found absolutely fascinating, I don't know if you remember, but for decades, the tobacco industry denied vehemently that smoking was addictive. And then in the year 2000, they completely switched around and sort of for some corporate reasons, Philip Morris conceded that, hey, you're right, smoking is addictive. We concede that. We're going to put that on our packages. We're going to warn you about it, right? Well, the fascinating thing that happened when they did that was that the company's scientists had to scramble because they didn't spend their entire working lives coming up with arguments, you know, against thinking of smoking as addictive. And now they had to flip around without losing face. And one of the things they realized is that the definition of addiction had changed over the years to be more inclusive and to have sort of fewer constraints. You know, one doesn't need to have painful withdrawal symptoms as one might with some drugs in order for a drug to be considered to be addictive. And so that same year in 2000, the CEO of Philip Morris was asked in legal proceedings what his definition of addiction was. And he says, addiction is a repetitive behavior that some people find difficult to quit. And I marveled at that definition, not just because it was so simple and inclusive and accepted by many sort of quarters of science, but at the time he gave that definition, Philip Morris was not just the largest manufacturer of cigarettes in North America. It was the single largest manufacturer of processed foods because it bought the old company General Foods and then Kraft and then Nabisco. And I argue in Hook that his definition of addiction fits perfectly many of the company's own food products at the time that they were in the grocery store.
Yeah. Well, that reminds me, you know, some of the companies actually gave themselves away when they had that famous potato chip brand. And they said, I bet you can't just eat one, you know, and that they're addicted. You'll eat that whole bag. And they even said it. And this was an interesting one, too. I remember watching a commercial. Now, I won't mention the brand. It was a hamburger fast food restaurant. Everyone knows what it is. I won't tell the company. But they had a commercial and they have a caricature of what that company represents for this brand of hamburger chain of restaurants. And they had this on television. This caricature, he's in the boardroom of the company and they're watching some advertising that they're going to put out. And
they're watching the commercial, and they have a commercial with a scientist in a white lab coat measuring this guy on the treadmill. And the doctor is saying, you know, studies show that if you eat hamburgers and French fries and you have chocolate milkshakes together, that you'll be stronger and healthier, and it'll make you really fit. So the caricature says, wow, where did we get that doctor? They said, oh, he used to work for the tobacco companies.
Yeah, that's a good one.
So, and that was actually on television. I couldn't believe it was on nationwide advertising. Let's talk about addiction and where does it actually begin? What's the physiology of this in the brain chemistry from what you've studied?
Well, you just said it. It is in the brain. Addiction happens in the brain. When it comes to food, one of the important things to realize is that we, by nature, are designed to be attracted to food. In fact, one of the scientists I spent time with pushed back a little bit at me and said, you know, Michael, it's not so much that food can be addictive, it's that we, by nature, are drawn to not just want to eat, but to overeat, which made sense for most of our existence. But the problem is, in the last 50 years, the food companies have changed the nature of our food so dramatically in a way that's made overeating, which used to be a good thing because we did it occasionally, a everyday thing in people's lives. So one of the hallmarks of addiction is speed. The faster a substance can hit the brain, the more apt we are to respond by acting compulsively, impulsively on that signal. And there's nothing, it turns out, faster than food, and especially these additives, say, for example, salt, sugar, fat, but other attributes of what I like to call fast groceries, in the way it can hit the reward center of the brain. And so, for example, a while ago, some scientists did this very clever experiment where they sat people down and they said, we want to test how fast you taste sweetness. So they put some sugar on their tongue and they asked them to push a button when they tasted the sweetness. And so food, because we're designed to be attracted to food, cheats a little bit. When you smoke a cigarette or buy alcohol or narcotics, it can take as long as 10 seconds for those substances to kind of fully engage the brain, right? But the sugar on the tongue hits the taste buds, which trips the sweet receptors in the taste buds, which then sends a signal to the brain saying sweet taste is coming in. And in those experiments, those people were pushing that button in 6 or 7 tenths of a second, compared to the full 10 seconds that smoking can take to fully engage the brain. And when I heard that, it really put the meaning of fast food or fast groceries in a whole light, because everything about these products, from their manufacture to their packaging to their formulation, is designed to be fast, to hit our brains quickly. And what happens in the brain, I love scientists who divide the brain into two. There's the go brain, which is kind of the more primitive part of the brain that gets us to do things that keep us alive, whether that's fleeing from danger or eating. And then there's the stop part of the brain, typically referred to in the frontal cortex of the brain, the executive function, the willpower, the free will. That's the part of the brain that says, hey, wait a minute, I'm not so sure it's a great thing to eat that whole bag of potato chips right now. The balance between those two parts of our brain shifts when we're confronted with these exquisitely engineered processed foods that get the go brain so excited, the stop brain doesn't have a chance of catching up and putting the brakes on that compulsive behavior.
Now, in your book, you mentioned that there's a lot, I think the title of the chapter is, it's all related to memory. Do our food memories lead to addiction, or what's the connection there?
Really, really important point. I started out the chapter with a famous chef food writer, Paula Wolford, who had such a sensitive palate that if somebody was salting boiling water, she could taste that water and tell if a different brand of salt than she was familiar with was being used. She was so sensitive to sort of taste and flavor. That was her business. Tragically, she began developing Alzheimer's, began losing her memory. And when she lost her memory, she began losing her taste. when I caught up with her, she was sprinkling hot chili peppers on her lovely green salad because chili was like the one thing she could still sort of taste enough in food. Memory is one of the ways that food is even more problematic than other addictive substances because we begin forming memories for food at a really young age, possibly even when we're still in the womb, depending on what our mother has been eating. And we carry those memories for a lifetime, and we associate those food memories with emotions. And so this is why the soda companies realize that if they put a soda in the hands of a kid when they're at a ballpark with their parents at one of the most joyous moments of their life up until that point, those kids will forevermore associate that soda with that joyous moment and then flip it around when they want some joy and comfort in their life. They know then to turn to soda based on the power of the food memories that they develop and the companies try so hard to own in our brands.
We hope you enjoyed part one of our two-part radio program interview with Michael Moss discussing his book, Hooked, Food, Free Will, and How the Food Giants Exploit Our Addictions. Now, to get a copy of Michael's book, you can get it through your local bookstore or also online through Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Penguin, Random House, and many other online retailers. So tune in next week to Health and Longevity right here on Life Talk Radio as I continue my interview with Michael Moss. If you would like to listen to past programs of Health and Longevity, go to our website at lifetalk.net and go to the podcast page and look for Health and Longevity, and you'll have access to all of our past radio shows.
Would you like to live a happier, healthier, and longer fulfilled life? Then visit us at healthandlongevityradio.com. That's one word, healthandlongevityradio.com. There you'll find valuable information and resources that can help you achieve optimal health and give you the secrets to longevity. Visit us today at healthandlongevityradio.com. Once again, that's healthandlongevityradio.com. It could change your life.
That's it for this week's program. Until our next broadcast, this is Dr. John Westerdahl wishing you the best of health and longevity.
This has been Health and Longevity with Dr. John Westerdahl, a production of Life Talk Radio. Join us again next week on the same station and time for Health and Longevity. The preceding information on this program has been general information about your health and is not to be taken as professional medical advice, nor is it intended to serve as a substitute for medical attention. Do not change your diet or exercise habits without guidance from your medical doctor, especially if you have health problems or are on medication. Do not change your medications without the advice and supervision of your medical doctor. If you have a medical condition, we encourage you to seek the consultation of a medical doctor experienced in dietary change and lifestyle medicine. And as always, we wish you the best of health.